Visioneers, Episode 5, Dark Passage.
We left the story in South America with the captain and his soldiers smashing their jeep into the tree. The broadcast of Luis Valdez is already underway.
Well, now, while events have been developing in Chile, another parallel stream of dramatic activity is flowing, this time in Jerusalem. Esther Fisher is at the center of it. She's been staying with David and Mina Roth, and their son Joshua and daughter Sarah. It's Saturday morning, and that's the Sabbath, of course, in Jerusalem, and Esther is just leaving to go to a kibbutz where she'll spend the weekend to begin her visioneering activities with a conference that's set up there. And the Roth family will stay in Jerusalem and spend their Sabbath as usual. And Jerry, would you give us the description here of the Roth family?
Well, the Roth family is not deeply religious. They keep the Sabbath quietly at home, reading, studying for the children, doing the simple household chores that have built up over the week. David is a government official and works as an administrative officer for social welfare programs. Mina teaches in the local elementary school 3 blocks away. The children are showing promise of becoming talented musicians. Joshua is a pianist and Sarah on the cello. Later in the day, as the Sabbath draws to a close, they'll gather in their small living room on the first floor apartment for a small recital. It has become a custom for them, and they'll be joined here by friends, adults, and children for these few hours of peaceful family time at the end of a busy work week.
Now, from here, we move to the kibbutz, where Esther is, as I said before, about to launch the visioneering project. She has a reputation as being one of Israel's leading artists, and this is a strong drawing card for the people who will come to participate in this event. She has come here with her friend Jenny Lovix. And now, as we pick the story up, it's early evening, after dinner, and Esther is standing to speak to the audience.
Chaverim, friends, shalom, she begins quietly. It's good to be here with you this evening. I have just a few brief remarks. Tonight is for relaxation. Tomorrow we'll have a workshop and be joined by Mark Venture, the leader of the Visioneers, and you'll hear about how that movement is gathering force to change the world. Tonight, I want to share a dream.
The room is hushed. All attention is focused on this young woman who they know and respect for her contribution to Israeli culture. She's wearing a long autumn-toned skirt which she gathers around her now as she sits perched on a high three-legged stool in the middle of the group. She picks up a simple wooden guitar which was leaning against the stool and begins to play.
She sings to them softly, songs they know, songs of peace and hope. Her voice is clear and tremulous, pitched to the tone of a distant bell ringing across the land. She sings, Heveinu shalom aleichem. Let us bring peace, peace to all of us. Hallelujah. Glory to the world, heart to heart, each to each. Hallelujah to the things that were and the things that have not been. Hallelujah to yesterday and to tomorrow. Hine ma tov, she sings. Hine ma tov umanayim shevet achim gam ya. Here's what's good. People sitting together, all of us here, the voices are rising now, joining with Esther. Oseh shalom aleinu, let him make peace among us. Everyone is singing, getting to their feet, joining hands, swaying to the music. Oseh shalom aleinu, let him make peace among us and to all Israel. And to that let us say, Amen. Everyone is standing, Esther too. Standing as they reach into their hearts and sing. Heads are high, everyone standing tall as the passionate music resonates in their hearts, then ends and the room settles into a hushed stillness as full of hope and longing for peace as the songs they have just sung.
And then Esther goes on to tell about her dream.
My good friends, I said I wanted to share a dream. It's a dream I've carried in my heart since I was a small girl. I'm walking in a beautiful garden full of flowers and fruit trees. There's no one in the garden but me, I'm walking there alone, hardly daring to breathe, lest I disturb the beauty and the stillness of it. I come to a wall, and it seems to me this must be the end of the garden, for it's a very high wall, much taller than I am. Somebody has put it there to say this is the end of the garden. I see it's an old wall, and there are cracks between large flat stones where the mortar has fallen out. I look more closely, and I see peeping from one of the cracks a note on a tiny piece of paper, crumpled, dirty, and bent a little. It's pushed as if pushed through the crack coming from the other side of the wall. I reach up and take the note and read it, and tears come to my eyes. It says, "Hello. I live in a garden on this side of this high wall. I used to think the wall was the end of the garden, but one day I climbed a tree and I could see over the wall, and I saw that on the other side of the wall was another garden, and I saw you walking there alone. And the thought came to me that perhaps the wall really wasn't the end of the garden after all. Maybe it was the middle, and someone had put the wall there, dividing the garden in two, but really it was one garden with a wall down the middle of it. Do you think that's a funny idea? I'm writing this note to tell you what I think. I hope you won't laugh at me and that you'll write back to me and tell you what you think." Well, the note wasn't signed, so I didn't know who sent it. I turned it over and quickly wrote a reply. "Hello, what an interesting thought. Perhaps the only way we can tell what it is if we visit each other. I'm too small to climb over this high wall, but if you throw a rope, maybe I could do it and meet you on top of the wall." I pushed the note through the wall and waited. Within a very short time, I heard a whooshing sound, and the end of a strong brown rope came over the wall. I grabbed hold of it and began to climb. I wasn't good at it, and it was taking me a long time to get to the top, and I was getting very tired. My arms were aching. I felt sure I would fall back and hurt myself. But then I looked up. I saw a hand reaching down toward me. I'll never forget that hand. It wasn't large, but it looked strong, and it was dark brown, like as if it had been tanned a long time in the sun. I reached up and grasped it. Right away, I felt new energy in my tired arms, and soon I was sitting on the top of the wall, facing my new friend. He said his name was Allie, and I told him I was Esther, and we looked on both sides of the wall. Sure enough, it seemed to both of us from up there that both sides looked very much the same, and perhaps it really was all one garden with a wall down the middle. And do you know that as soon as we began to think that way, we felt the wall begin to shudder. We could see it suddenly breaking down piece by piece in the distance and traveling towards us. Allie gave me his hand again, and we barely had time to scramble down his side of the wall before the whole thing crumbled and lay in a pile of rocks stretching as far away as we could see. We stood there and looked. And after a few minutes, except for the pile of rocks, we could have said there was never a wall there at all. After that, I played with Allie on what had been his side of the wall, and he played with me on what had been my side. And we found we knew mostly the same games and songs, and what we didn't know, we taught each other quickly. Esther's voice had grown very soft, but every person in the room was listening intently. That was the end of my dream. And I've carried it through all my life in Israel, through all the bombings and the wars and the hijacking and the missile attacks and the hatred and the violence and the strikes. And I find myself saying now more than ever, what if all of us, Jew, Arab, Palestinian, and Israeli, came to see that what we have is one land with a wall down the middle of it. And if we take down the wall, then there are ways we can learn to live together and find that we already know most of each other's songs and games. And from there, it's only a short step to learn to sing together, hallelujah for the things that are still to come. That's the message of the Visioneers, my friends. It's the thought, it's the dream that I want to leave with you tonight. Tomorrow, we'll talk about it together. For now, let us stand and sing Hatikva. Kalod balevav pnima, nefesh Yehudi homia.
Hatikvah, the hope. The hope to be a free people in their homeland. The bewitching melody tugs at their hearts while Esther's dream stirs in their minds. The song ends and Esther smiles at them, then turns and steps quickly out of the room into the fresh evening air to walk by herself for a while under the clear, star-filled sky.
In sharp contrast to Esther's dream, a string of events now take place in Jerusalem that seem to tear away any hope for the future. It begins at the Roth apartment. David and Mina are hosting their customary Sabbath evening event. Joshua and Sarah are entertaining.
A colleague of David's, Peter Cardus, arrives, and he notices outside the building a suspicious-looking car, and he tries to move it. It's at that moment that the bomb goes off. Upstairs, the whole front wall of the Roth apartment is blown out. The small grand piano where Joshua had been seated a few moments earlier spins crazily around, then topples forward and hangs precariously at the point of balance, without falling into the street. Chairs, coffee tables, a stereo player, all are blown clear out of the building, and one of the chairs lands strangely intact in the branches of a tree 50 meters away. Four people have been killed in the blast. Peter Cardus, bravely trying to avert the tragedy by pushing the car clear, is blown to pieces. His efforts unquestionably prevented many more deaths upstairs. An elderly couple, the Horschbergs, sitting by the front window, were crushed by the concussion and died instantly. Joshua Roth, beautiful young man and promising pianist, dies in his mother's arms a few minutes later, herself cut and bleeding profusely. David Roth had been at the back of the apartment in the kitchen and has escaped without a scratch. Sarah was thrown hard against a wall and is sobbing hysterically as she looks down helplessly at her crushed and broken left hand, which a few minutes earlier had fingered Albinoni so delicately on the cello. The remaining guests are all in various states of injury and shock. Somewhere out in Jerusalem's dark streets, the sirens begin to scream. Somewhere out there as well, two young men in sneakers and black jackets hurry away from their ghastly handiwork. As they jump into a compatriot's car and speed off, their minds are closed to the horror and the rage that screams out from the twisted building with its gaping black hole of death. Too many times, O Jerusalem, have you seen such butchery and horror. Too much death. Too much hatred. Too much mindless revenge that does nothing but keep an ugly score. As the sirens draw closer, keeping their frenzied appointment with the latest dead and injured, there's a whisper somewhere out in the universe saying, "This cannot be." Quietly, it gathers the force that it must find to break the tyranny of the dark minds that infect the human condition.
And this is not the end of the horror. Esther and Jenny, hearing about the blast, get in their car, intending to scramble to Jerusalem. On the way, the car is pushed off the side of the road. The women are forced out of the car and kidnapped.
Now, Mark hears about this in the visioneering room, and it's at this point that we get a particular device of the novel, because up to now, Mark has really been a confidant of you, the listener, the participant, watching all of this and creating it in the visioneering room. But now, with all of this tragedy in Jerusalem, Mark elects to become just another character and move into the story, and you send him to Jerusalem, where he immediately goes in search of what he must do. Now, he goes, first of all, to the hospital, where David is waiting. He's there waiting for the outcome of the surgery of his daughter Sarah and his wife Mina. And it's at this point that Mark learns about David's involvement as a leader of a group of Israeli Avengers. And it's for this reason that the bomb blast was set against him. And it's the old story of the eye for the eye and the tooth for the tooth. And Mark is appalled at the implications of this and the horror and devastation that it's bringing. And he himself then undergoes vigorous interrogation from the Israeli authorities. And he has a very long night of it. And it's next morning now, on Sunday morning, and he receives a rather strange phone call. And I'll read this to you. "Mr. Venture." It's a thick voice, male, obviously disguised. "Yes, who's this?" "It doesn't matter. If you want to see your friend Esther Fisher alive again, you will listen." Mark stiffens. "Is this Esther's captor on the other end of the line?" "I'm listening." "I have read in the paper what you said about the visioneers. We Palestinians have a vision too. It's to be free in our homeland. What do you say about that?"
"I think that's a fine vision for a group of people to hold. Our vision does not include the state of Israel."
"Well, there I think you have a problem."
"No, you have a problem, Mr. Venture. You have a group of visioneers to represent the world, and you include someone from a state we Palestinians do not recognize. That's not acceptable to us."
"The visioneers are not a formal body put together by governments. There have been too many of those in the past, and they don't work. The visioneers are a group of people talking to each other about a future vision of the world. They come from every continent. They're working now to encourage people in all communities to build visions and share them with each other around a common vision for all of us, the future of our planet. That's what Esther was here to do."
"Yes, and she begins with her own people. That's not very credible to us."
"We always begin with our own people. Where would you begin?"
"You didn't ask me."
"I don't know you. I began where I began. Esther was here to widen the circle. Inadvertently, you may have helped her to do that. But your methods are crude."
"No one is asking you to approve of my methods, Mr. Venture. Miss Fisher was taken because she's an associate of that murderer, Roth."
"I don't believe Esther knew anything about what Roth was doing."
"It doesn't matter. We have her now, so there can be no retaliation. Or she'll be sent back with her throat cut."
Mark feels his own throat gorge as he hears the hatred in the voice and knows that Esther is there, vulnerable to it. But he keeps his voice steady.
"You have a much better opportunity now than anything you can achieve by such savagery. Look, we don't know each other. We're just two voices at two ends of a phone line, talking about one of the world's most intractable problems. But we're talking, not killing. A week ago, no one had heard of the visioneers. By tomorrow morning, our work will be known throughout the world, and millions of people will be talking and starting to look at many things in a new way. You have an opportunity to be a prominent part of that."
"Yes, and to find myself rotting in an Israeli prison for the rest of my days for my trouble."
"I don't know what you've done already that you might be held accountable for, other than abducting Esther. But you have a chance now to turn that to your advantage by bringing her back."
"Just walk into your camp, eh, Mr. Venture? Where would I see a friendly face there? Jews and Christians. You have no sense of who I am and what I see."
"We have a Jordanian on the visioneering team." There's a pause. Mark holds his breath, waiting to see if this has scored a point.
"Who is that?" the voice finally asks.
"Mohammed Hussein. He's an official at the United Nations headquarters in New York."
"I know him."
"Yeah, he's a good man.
Is he there with you?"
"No, he's in China."
"Why is he in China when his people are here? A fifth of the world's people are in China. I had need of him there. But he can be here by this evening."
Another pause.
"You bring him here, Mr. Venture. Then we can talk again."
"Good. Now I have something to ask of you."
"What?"
"Let me speak to Esther." There's a pause and some scuffling sounds on the phone. Then Esther's voice is there, unmistakably clear and brave.
"Mark? Mark, is that you?"
"Yes, Esther. God, your voice sounds wonderful. Are they treating you well?"
"Yes, we're fine. I could hardly believe it when they showed me the paper this morning and let us listen to the radio. You seem to be big news in Israel today.
I haven't even seen any of that myself yet. Listen, we can't talk long now. I'm working to get you out of there. I know I can count on you to do what you can. I love you, Esther. But she's gone. Enough, the voice is back. We'll speak again, Mr. Venture. And the line is dead. Mark looks at the receiver and hangs it up. He notices for the first time the streams of perspiration running down his face and the tight knot in his stomach.
The events surrounding the Visioneers attract worldwide media attention. Mark is interviewed on ZNN, a worldwide news network. The interviewer is Pamela Barrett, who will appear many times from now on.
And this worldwide interest is certainly building up around the Louis Valdez broadcast, because all around the world, the Visioneers are stirring up interest. In America, Bill Bates and Julia McCarthy have lined up the major networks to take the broadcast. Europe, too, is primed, and the broadcast will be seen in Jerusalem at 4 a.m. on Monday morning. And at midnight, Mark goes to see David and Mina Roth at the funeral home where their son Joshua is to be buried tomorrow. Mark has decided to move on freeing Esther early Monday morning, just after daybreak. And he goes to ask David at midnight to join him. And then together they go to the airport at Tel Aviv to pick up Mohammed Hussein. Now it's after 3 a.m. Mark has made arrangements with the ZNN to watch the Louis Valdez broadcast at their studios. When they arrive, Pamela Barrett, who had interviewed Mark 16 hours earlier, is there.
Hello. You see, you convinced me this is one broadcast I shouldn't miss. We're recording it and we'll broadcast it at 8 a.m. Who are your friends?
Mark introduces David and Mohammed. Pamela's journalist's instincts are immediately aroused when she realizes what the three of them together represent.
Why do I have this feeling I'm standing at the edge of history with you fellows? Can you fill me in?
There'll be no interviews now, Pamela. Maybe later. I'll let you know. Thank you for arranging this part of it.
Okay, Mark, but I know a good story when I smell one, and I'm sure picking up the scent here.
With that, she leaves them to talk over coffee in the studio lounge while they wait for Louis Valdez.
Now we come to the first climax of the story, the broadcast by Louis Valdez. A worldwide interest has been built up, and the ugly scenes in Jerusalem involving Mark and Esther have highlighted it. You must remember the desperate attempt by the Chilean soldiers disguised as civilians to stop it and where we left them. When we left the scene, the broadcast had begun. The soldier had crashed into a tree with a mission in sight. Valdez is broadcasting in English with Spanish subtitles. He invites viewers, millions of them throughout the world, to follow him in their imagination.
And he begins by inviting them to imagine a world far different from the one that we now know, a world where people would be living in harmony with each other and with the natural environment. And then he asks them to compare that to the world that they know. Look, my friends, look in your minds and see yourselves living in such a world. How is it different from what we know today and from what we know of history? See there. See how we would hold in great respect the sanctity of human life. We would not kill or slaughter in battle, or allow to perish in hunger or neglect any one of these our brothers and sisters, each one the most marvelous creature of a supreme and wonderful creation, whose minds and souls are alive with the same universal energy. Our minds would know nothing of destruction and violence against a fellow human being. There could be no thought of that, no badge of honor for taking human life, no comfort in material riches while others suffer in the agony of despair and deprivation. How would we build our economies if our first thought was for our brothers rather than ourselves? How rich would we find ourselves in resources if we turned away from building weapons of destruction? How much energy and wealth would we find if we put aside the conflict of legal battle and fierce, aggressive competition?
So he points to another way for human beings to act by using their creative minds to create visions of what could be rather than what thou shalt not be. And go on.
Valdez continues. But now, my friends, we know that there can be another way, because swelling up across the whole vast richness of the human minds on this planet is a revulsion at our failure as the most noble creature on God's earth to live up to our nobility. And out of this moment of crisis, we are poised to take the great leap forward, to turn inwards in our minds, to discover there the bold and beautiful images of another world, and to raise them clear and shining, and to strengthen them every day by each rich mind adding its piece of positive creation, daring to imagine what we can be, what the world can be, what life on earth can be, because we, as its co-creators, have seen it and decided that this will be so.
With his words, energy and passion have flooded into Luis Valdez's face. Those watching in the studio are transfixed with a power concentrating around the slight man. And beyond the studio, the energy projects through the harsh and critical scrutiny of the television cameras, transforming the medium, overcoming its limitations, because deep in the soul of this one man is the burning desire to move the world to see what he can see and bring it within the grasp of enough to make it happen. He continues without pause, spinning out image upon image of the possible, in every setting, in every land, challenging, provoking, calling upon everyone to see and to act and to come together in a surging wave of visioneering across the face of the earth. Minutes ticks by unnoticed as this one man calls up across every time zone the latent yearning creativity of humankind for peaceful, empowering coexistence.
My friends, the world is about to transform to a new age of enlightenment, gathering together around the powerful visions for good that lie in the hearts of the overwhelming majority of human beings on the planet. Those visions will now come forward and wash over the ugly, scarred remnants of a violent past, which we will not accept as the future. We are taking the future into our hands. We are enlivening our minds with visions of the possible. We are taking away the power from those who too long have held us back from all that we can be. Tomorrow, I ask you to go out and form yourselves into bands of visioneers. Put up your dreams. Talk to each other and listen. Listen deeply to the wisdom of your collective minds at work, building something strong and rich and beautiful for all. This is our heritage. This is the nobility of our human spirit. This is the time of a new and wonderful beginnings. This, my friends, is...
But Luis Valdez does not finish the statement. At that moment, a resounding crash reverberates in the studio. The priest turns on camera and sees what the watching world cannot see. A blood-stained figure, his clothes ripped and half torn from his body, has stumbled wide-eyed and ghastly into the studio. In shaking hands, he levels, as he comes, a heavy .45 caliber revolver, aiming it directly at Luis Valdez.
Now, priest, die for El Condor. The words spit out as excrement of hate. The revolver explodes once, twice, three times, and the heavy slugs slam into the priest's chest, flinging him with their dreadful impact against the back wall of the set. Transfixed and immobile with horror, the camera operator keeps his camera trained on the priest, and a gasping world watches. Blood spreads over the simple white cassock. With a howl of rage, George Cardinal launches himself forward around the set towards the intruder. The revolver turns towards him. He weaves. The shot rings out and he feels its hot breath sear his cheek. A second shot also passes harmlessly. Then he's upon the man, whom he recognizes now as the army captain he had first watched through binoculars only a week ago. The fury of Cardinal's attack carries him crashing against the far wall of the room. The revolver spins free from the assailant's hand as Cardinal pounds the man's head incessantly on the floor. In a moment, all resistance is gone, and the captain lies twisted and senseless by the door. It all happened in less than 30 seconds. The second camera operator also acted instinctively and followed Cardinal's attack. His co-worker, recovering slightly, switches the image being transmitted to the world away from the dying priest to the shaking picture of Cardinal hammering the attacker senseless. The camera continues to roll as Cardinal now leaps to his feet and rushes back to Louis Valdez. What the camera shows is then etched indelibly into the minds of millions of viewers across every continent.
The burly Cree Indian chief, tears streaming down his face, tenderly takes the head of his friend in two huge hands and presses his lips to the now lifeless face. His body shuddering with uncontrollable grief, Cardinal gathers the crumpled figure in his arms. He comes slowly to his feet and turns to face the camera. The world sees the slight figure in blood-stained cassock, who only moments earlier had spoken so passionately about a future vision of peace and love, lying lifeless in the arms of his friend. The head hangs back, and one arm falls loosely towards the floor. For those who can recognize it, it's the very image of the Pietà, the crucified Christ cradled in the arms of his mother. For others, it sears into memory as a testament of the ruthless violence the victim had denounced and which the world can no longer tolerate. George Cardinal speaks into the great hush that has settled in the studio and around the world.
In his closing words, he was going to talk of love. There was no one more qualified to do it. Lying here in my arms is a man who had more love in his heart than it seems the world can hold. He was going to say that the world cannot continue in senseless conflict. He could see in the hearts of his fellow human beings something better than that. Now here he is, struck down by the very violence he sought to replace with love. Was he right? Was he right, this sweet and gentle man, to have such hope and vision for the world? I swear at the moment I cannot tell. My heart howls out in anger that the world could take his life like this. He did his best, and now he's here, broken and bleeding for it. He couldn't even finish the broadcast, and I must do it for him, so he might have the dignity of a decent closing. The world at least owes him that much. A decent closing. George Cardinal is struggling for words. He wants desperately to end the whole horrible nightmare. Louis Valdez is signing off for the last time. Not in the way he would have wished, but as the world has chosen to give him. God grant that the world may now be the better for it.
With that, George Cardinal turns and carries his friend abruptly off the set. The camera continues to run for a few moments, recording only the blue world globe and the empty space beside it. Then, a confused and still terrified technician cuts the light and ends the transmission. Around the world, a stunned audience continues to watch while local stations struggle to find their own ways of interpreting what has happened.